Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. When COVID-19 hit the U.S. hard in mid-March, college and university campuses across the country were shuttered. Students quickly left their dormitories and classes shifted online. Now, state-funded schools face budget cuts. Private schools with modest endowments need to pare scholarships. And any college or university financially struggling before the pandemic is on a tightrope. Some are just adjusting to the new normal, and some are throwing in the towel. Melissa Korn is a reporter covering higher ed for The Wall Street Journal. Welcome to the show, Melissa.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know, this didn't happen in a vacuum. There were challenges facing a lot of categories of higher ed before the pandemic.
Absolutely. Schools overall weren't in fantastic shape before the pandemic hit. You had pressures in terms of enrollment, tuition revenue, is very tight. A lot of schools discount their tuition rates to lure in students, which means they don't actually make much money on any given student. So if enrollment falls, that's a big hit to the bottom line. You had state budget concerns. There were so many other factors at play that when the pandemic hit, it really did put schools in, that were already and challenging times into quite a tailspin.
It felt like at that time, before the pandemic, when I was covering this issue in general, that there was a culture shift taking place.
Yeah, there was. There's been a really broad rethink of the role and value of higher education in America for a number of years now, as costs have continued to rise. And you know, there's a lot of discussion of what the payoff is for a college degree, and the answer is it depends on who you are, what you study, where you go, and what you want to do with your life.
And how much money is worth to you, I mean, ultimately.
Exactly. A $10,000 bill means something different for different families.
You wrote that from schools already on the brink to the loftiest institutions, the pandemic is changing higher education in America with stunning speed. And I'm wondering what the relevance of that speed piece is.
Schools, universities generally do not move quickly in much of anything. There's shared governance where faculty, staff, and administrators make decisions together. So for them to shut down their residential operations largely, shift to online instruction in a matter of weeks is really extraordinary for these institutions. They've never done anything like that before. But that has come with a lot of hiccups, and it's still playing out. We don't know for sure who's going to be able to reopen their campuses come fall. Will they have to continue this online instruction throughout next semester? What does that look like? Is it any good? There's a ton of questions, and the schools are just moving quickly.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the impact on higher ed and how higher ed could and may and probably will change in the wake of this pandemic, amid it and in the wake of it. My guest right now is Melissa Korn. She covers higher ed for The Wall Street Journal, and she's been covering this issue. Listeners, I'd love to hear from parents. I'd love to hear from students about what you're thinking about coming up next fall. Are you thinking about pulling out? Are you thinking about a gap year? Are you thinking about alternative education? Coming up, we're going to hear from an organization that provides an alternative education for people who want to get into the music business. We're also going to hear from independent universities and colleges, an organization that represents them. The number to call is 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You wrote about a prediction from scholar Robert Zemsky, author of the new book, The College Stress Test. And what's he saying? How has he modified his predictions?
Yeah, so he had said that, there will be significant numbers of school closures in coming years. And he ramped up his prediction of just how many schools could close, even in the next year or two, if campuses can't reopen in the fall. Schools, even ones that have fairly large endowments, that's not just a big pile of cash sitting there ready for them to use for whatever they want. The funds are generally restricted. So if schools aren't getting tuition payments or room and board payments, they can't keep the lights on for very long.
But something like Harvard that has billions and billions in endowment, right?
Right. So even schools like Harvard, like Princeton, yes, they have a lot of money in the bank, but they can't just shift the funds from one purpose to another. They also have very high expenses. So even those schools are going through really extreme belt tightening right now, cutting back on capital projects, really pausing any new construction. Leadership are taking pay cuts. They're freezing salaries. They're freezing hiring. These are changes that schools haven't made, you know, really since the Great Recession, if they were that extreme then.
Mm-hmm.
And some weren't, because it was kind of a slower progression 12 years ago than it is right now. This all happened so quickly. The schools, many of them are caught off guard.
You know,
everyone was.
Speaking of, we all have, capital, speaking of capital budget cuts, schools have been spending more on capital improvement over the last couple decades than ever. And this past decade has been astounding. They've been spending more on, you know, science labs, rec centers, dormitories to attract more and higher paying students, right? How have those investments made them more vulnerable at this time?
Right. So because they've invested so much in their physical plants, in their campuses, schools have pretty high overhead costs. Right, it costs a lot to keep those places heated and air conditioned and maintained, and new roofs are needed every little while. So, just even if they cut certain expenses, those things still stay. There's debt payments on a lot of those construction investments, things like that as well. So it's not like a school can just downsize its budget across the board. Certain things they still have to pay the bills for. So that could become a liability, especially if campuses don't reopen entirely come fall. That's just empty space sitting there.
I'm thinking about if they happen to open up the dorms or some of the dorms, they're going to have to lower the population in the dorms. That's going to lower the revenue, but not the overhead costs, not the debt payments, that kind of thing.
Absolutely. A lot of schools are figuring out just how to manage their density of their campuses come fall or come next year, and likely for a few years after that.
You know, and if I'm a student and I'm paying to get an online course at, you know, Ohio State versus maybe an in-person or an online with somebody at a local community college or something like that, these are all things that students are taking into consideration as well, right?
Yes, a lot of families are thinking about how much they're willing to pay for what kind of education next term. You know, they generally did not get tuition refunds this spring when classes moved online. Some got refunds for room and board mm-hmm. when they left campus. But is the degree, is the instruction as valuable, worth as much money if it's online? If it's done well, maybe. If it's kind of a slapdash effort, probably not. And these families and the schools are figuring out what the appropriate price point might be.
I've always wondered, when it comes to online learning, I can see, you know, over the years they've gotten better at it and there's value in it in a certain way in certain situations. But if you're going to Harvard or Princeton, wherever the fancy schools are, a lot of that's being there and knowing people and meeting people and rubbing elbows, so to speak.
Right. So many people choose a residential college experience for that residential college, so that they can live with their classmates and have those late night discussions and grab coffee with a professor. And you can't do that online. That doesn't mean that online is bad. It's
right.
Just different and not necessarily what these students signed up for to begin with.
You noted with the particular vulnerability for universities with major medical centers. And Ohio State has both a major medical center and a major sports program. And I'm wondering, do universities like Ohio State suffer? I mean, Johns Hopkins is one thing, but they're not also depending on a sports program.
Right. The schools that have a big sports program are really anxious about what happens come football season. The general understanding is there really won't be college sports until people are back on campus at colleges. So that could be a potential huge revenue blow for schools like Ohio State. On the medical center front, so many hospitals stopped doing elective procedures, reallocated their energy and resources to focus on treating COVID-19 patients. So revenue from those elective procedures just stopped quickly. And that's going to be a big financial hit for some of the universities that have alliances with hospitals.
if there's a big hit to the football program at a place like Ohio State, that hits all the sports programs all the way down the food chain. And I'm wondering, you know, what that has to do with maybe the American Council on Education's predictions about student enrollment for next fall. If I'm not getting the scholarship, to play tennis, what am I going to do?
Yeah, so we're not entirely sure what schools are going to be doing yet in terms of budget cuts for athletic programs. I don't think they know yet because they don't know what the financial hit will be.
Right.
It all depends on whether there's going to be football.
Tuition from international students will drop considerably, and I know that schools depend on that as well.
Yeah, there are some schools where 15-20% of their students come from overseas each year, and with visa processing pretty much stalled for months now, the schools are kind of having to model out what it would look like if they don't have international students on campus come fall. And that's an extraordinary possibility. That's a very scary future for them to be looking at. And it's likely not super long lasting, but it could be for a semester or even a year.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big revenue blow. So many colleges are looking to enroll more domestic students who can pay full freight to kind of make up the difference. But there's only so many of those students,
right,
too.
And I think you mentioned in another article I read, or maybe it was something else, that there's now the competition. There has been poaching, you know, summer poaching before, but now it's like full front and center.
Yeah.
Because of the competition.
Schools, right. They're going after everyone they possibly can, whether or not the student already committed to another school. Hundreds of institutions have extended their deposit deadlines. They're running kind of deals. They're saying, you know, if you commit to us now, we'll waive this fee or give you preference for that. And even with all of that, though, they still don't really know who's going to show up come August, come September.
They're doing things like putting off or delaying down payments and that kind of a thing to give people more flexibility, too.
Absolutely. The families want to know what they're signing up for. They want to know what school will look like next term before they commit to paying tens of thousands of dollars in many cases.
Well,
so they're just, and they also need to figure out their own finances.
Right.
You know, you've got unemployment claims through the roof. Their family's financial situations have changed so quickly that they need to do some new budgeting.
And this is giving more power for a change to students and where they go.
It is. You're seeing admit rates of some of the most selective schools start to tick up a little bit this year for the first time in a long time. Doesn't mean it's easy to get into an Ivy League school, but it's slightly easier. The families, especially those who can afford full tuition, they have some more power. They have a little bit more heft behind it when they call a school and say, hey, I'm not really sure I want to commit quite yet. What can you do for me?
Right. One thing they're offering is lots of gap years, I guess.
Right. Giving families and giving students the opportunity to take a year, knowing that things are just so uncertain for the fall, and then come and enroll the following year. So there's that commitment, that guaranteed revenue down the line, and it gives the student a chance to do something else. What else they'll do in that year depends, with travel fairly limited, the job market not exactly robust.
Right. It's an interesting equation when it comes to financial recessions or whatever we're going to call this in the future that we're going to be going through and the relationship with college enrollment and that kind of a thing. You said that the pandemic is exposing flaws in business models for universities and colleges. How so?
So things like that reliance on international students, the focus on the residential college experience, can these schools still have an identity without that residential experience? What product are they actually selling to families? And then also the high tuition, high discount model, which has been flawed and complicated for a very long time with very high sticker price that almost nobody pays. Here, when you have families scrambling to make ends meet pretty much overnight, That model really, some of those cracks there are exposed.
What about the physical size of these universities now?
In terms of the ground campus?
Yeah. Or? Yeah. I attended Arizona State for a year, 100 years ago, and it was like 23,000 students. That was nothing. Now it's 56,000 or something like that. It's incredibly bigger.
Yeah. So, you know, some schools that are very large, it really depends on if they're rural or urban.
Okay.
You know, a school in New York City right now might not be as appealing as a school in rural Wisconsin because you can spread out more in Wisconsin, in, you know, on a rural campus somewhere.
Okay.
You don't have to be all cramped together. So it's that size. It's also about geographic location, which then affects the density.
Hmm. Well, Melissa Korn, I hope I can call on you again. I really appreciate your time today.
Absolutely. Thanks so much.
Melissa Korn, higher education reporter for The Wall Street Journal. We're talking about higher education and guess what else? The pandemic, how it's affected the equations that higher education administrators have to deal with coming up, not just to deal with this spring, but going forward into the fall and maybe next year. We don't know when there's going to be a vaccine. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. If you're a student, what are you thinking about? Give us a call. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The coronavirus has forced private and public colleges and universities to get creative with shrinking budgets and increased competition for students with the academic chops and the money. Christopher Washington is executive vice president of Franklin University, formerly held the same position at the now closed Urbana University branch campus. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Ann.
And also C. Todd Jones, he's president and general counsel of the Association of Independent Colleges and Universities of Ohio. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
I wanted to ask you, Christopher Washington, what was the pandemic and the pressure of the pandemic? What clinched the decision for Urbana to close?
Well, you know that, you know, Urbana has had a history of struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we Franklin University acquired it about 6 years ago as it was about to close at that time. And we committed ourselves to trying to make improvements to the campus, you know, based on our competencies, the technology enhanced instruction, growth strategies. We believe that the combination of the high touch of the Urbana campus and our abilities with teaching effectiveness, new program development could really attract more students. And then you have this pandemic that comes out of the blue. I mean, the World Health Organization decides that, you know, there's a pandemic, there's a stay-at-home order issued in Ohio. And then all of a sudden, we have this unprecedented situation that we have to adapt to. And mm-hmm. it certainly had a dramatic impact on our ability to operate.
What was the tipping point? What was it? What number did you look at? Was it a bottom line thing? Was it just looking forward and thinking it's just not worth this?
The effects of this pandemic negatively impacted just about every aspect of our operation, not just revenue forecasts. Enrollment predictions started to drop significantly in terms of actual applications coming in, and our expenses increased significantly. So it was more of a broad, comprehensive impact of this on a rural campus that was already suffering from low enrollment.
You know, Todd, according to a survey, it was by a coalition, Council of Independent Colleges, the American Association of State Colleges and Universities, the Chronicle of Higher Education. The survey says that 60% of schools in your category missed their fall enrollment targets, and that was before the pandemic, right?
That was correct.
Yeah. So this was already, you know, there were already struggles going into this.
Absolutely. On the other hand, it is the nature of the sector that folks are trying to make enrollment targets and build out from there, but also set up structures where they're planning for not being able to make enrollment targets. What do you do if you end up being short? How do you react with your structure? So that's also built into the planning for a coming year for an institution.
Most of the independent colleges have housing, have a residential piece to them, or not necessarily?
Out of the 50 that will open this fall in our sector, about 46, 47 have no residential facilities in the sense that you would think of them. And Franklin University would be one of those examples.
Right. Christopher Washington, you're now with Franklin, back with Franklin University, and I'm wondering, how is this changing the conversation about what Franklin is going forward?
Well, Franklin has served a different segment of the population than Urbana University. Urbana has been a residential campus historically, serving, 18 to 21-year-olds, typically individuals coming right out of high school, looking for that residential campus experience, looking for sports. Franklin's different. It has served adult populations of, professionals and those seeking to participate in professional careers. And we've done that in a variety of modalities that include face-to-face courses, but also online and hybrid courses. And so our experiences in the last few months has been rather favorable in terms of new student applications for enrollment in our professional programs.
I think the key word there is professional, the professional programs. That's different than, a lot of private universities and colleges, what we think of Todd Jones, right? I mean, there's categories within the category.
Yeah, so in our state, I'm sorry, Todd.
Go ahead. Christopher?
Oh, I was just going to say that our Franklin University doesn't have the kind of vulnerabilities that was mentioned earlier in terms of residential hall dependency or dependence on sports programs. Mm-hmm. It really is providing the education for adults in partnership with companies, assessing those needs and responding quickly to adapt to the needs of the professions, which are rapidly changing. And I think in that market, there's opportunity for growth and sustainability.
Todd Jones?
Well, I was going to say that one of the things that people think about when they think about residential colleges is that liberal arts degree, liberal arts experience. The reality of the degrees being sought by students tend to be in a more professional vein than they were 50 years ago. So you have large numbers of people in teaching. You have large numbers in nursing and related health sciences. You have a large number of business students. So the number that are taking philosophy, the number that are taking history, the traditional liberal arts degrees are far smaller. However, the ethos of the campus and the larger education that is provided is around a liberal arts model, giving a student a larger view of the world. So it's a little of both.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I think of is it's some of my most memorable courses. I was always going to be in journalism. It was very profession-oriented for me, but I went to a Big Ten university where I had a great liberal arts education, and some of my most memorable courses came from that. Are you worried at all that we're going to lose that stripe, Todd Jones?
I'm not worried about it because of COVID. I am worried over time as to whether there is a professionalization of the degree sought by students. But in a sense, that's a cultural issue in our country and a view of what the purpose of higher education is. And hopefully that larger ethos of the liberal arts community within universities will help shape that for people who are going to have children 20 years from now, and people will still value that experience.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. That's C. Todd Jones. He's president and general counsel for the Association of Independent Colleges and Universities of Ohio. Also with us, Christopher Washington, executive vice president of Franklin University. He held the same position at the now-closed Urbana University branch campus of Franklin. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Aaron Green, CEO of College Liftoff, you're on the air. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, Dan. How are you doing today?
Good, thanks. So, if I remember correctly, your company helps students find the right school.
Yes, we work with families on planning for college, academically, financially. It's more so like looking at it as, actually a lot of guests have discussed already, as a value buy and how to really get the best return on value for that. I mean, we're in this point in our career, or at this point with everything, where we're buying and it's the equivalent of a house. So we've got to make decisions of that magnitude.
Well, so how is it? How has that changed with the pandemic?
Well, the interesting thing is it hasn't. And I really appreciate Melissa and C-Tad and Chris for actually pointing that out, that a lot of this stuff hasn't changed based on COVID. Now, COVID has been more of a catalyst for what's really gone on. I think Melissa's brought that up more poignantly about the financials really playing a toll now, where schools are now starting to show that it's more than just grades and test scores that they're going after and how they're giving scholarship money. We've been noticing that for years.
Right.
It's barely about knowing when the right points are to start asking for money, and it's really about understanding yield numbers for universities more than it is about really even grades and test scores, especially for middle-income families.
You know, that seems so harsh.
It really
to think
does,
about
and I'm sorry to say it. It sounds so dogmatic and poignant, but I always want to make sure that our families are smart consumers, because this is such a large decision.
Yeah.
One, it's cost equivalent of their house on paper. But to start with that. Two, there's 4,200 of them out there, each one with 200 different majors. So there's so much choice, and then it's the kids' future at stake. So in our position, especially college level stuff, we just want to make sure that everybody understands what is really happening and what's going on. Not to dissuade, in fact, not even to take away from the educational outcomes. It's actually meant to enhance it. When we understand our situation better, we become better decision makers, and we can find educational paths that make the most sense.
You know, Todd Jones, a sense about people like Aaron Green and the kind of work they do and the needs of the consumers, the students, their families. Is it becoming, it's more sophisticated. It has to be.
Well, there's no question that, you know, people are taking very sophisticated measures to seek out the college that's right for them, especially if they have the resources. But we also have to remember part of the efforts around more people being able to access colleges around people who are first-generation students, low-income students. And part of what our colleges do right now is seek to entice them to even consider college or to understand, yes, you can afford college. You know, because your parent waits tables and your father works on a lawn crew, you can still afford college because of the aid our colleges and our federal government and state government provide. And that really is going to be one of the keys for a policy sense going forward.
Is putting all those pieces of the puzzle together for them.
That's right. And making sure that more people like that are able to access college. Because, you know, you go back to the 70s, the old slogan, a mind is a terrible thing to waste. Mm-hmm. Well, in our economy, where more and more jobs are dependent upon having skills that you acquire as part through a college degree, we're going to need every one of those people we can find. And particularly with the retiring of the baby boom, we're going to have all of those people age out in a workforce that needs more of these high-skilled people.
Do you see an opening here, Christopher Washington, to make changes, to pivot quickly in certain directions because of the pandemic?
You know, Todd brings up a really good point. And, you know, we have needs for lifelong learning. We have diversity of institutions that can provide those needs. And from the standpoint of Franklin University, the answer is yes. We need to look at and continue to assess, you know, what's going on in the professions, how they're evolving, how we adapt our curriculum and program offerings to meet those needs, and to do that for people who perhaps miss the opportunity earlier on or see opportunities to advance their career. And Franklin, yes, absolutely sees an opportunity to do that.
I'm wondering, and I know that neither of you necessarily have insights into this per se, but how I remember interviewing an administrator for a culinary school up in the Upper Peninsula some months ago that had just started a relationship with Lake Superior State University or a state college up there to give it some foundation, institutional foundation, a fiduciary foundation, that kind of a thing. Do you see at all a place where schools like Franklin branch out, make connections with other kind of teaching organizations that may not be traditional university?
We've partnered with a variety of different kinds of institutions. Perhaps most prominent is the relationships that we have with community colleges.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've been a transfer-friendly institution since 1999, when you know, a lot of schools typically did not accept credit from community college. Today, it's quite popular, actually, but we were a pioneer in creating a community college alliance, and we look at these partnerships as pathways. And so how do we develop programs that enable someone to go from an associate degree to a bachelor's degree in a field where there's high demand, or working with companies in particular to offer cohort experiences for their employees, their job incumbents, to enrich their skills so they can take on more advanced work. I mean, all these kinds of things are important to have a holistic response to the needs today.
Mm-hmm. And Todd Jones, what about independent colleges and universities at large? In a lot of places, they're very important to local economies. They may be the largest institution in a small town. Have they changed, or are they seeing a way to change with this pandemic upon us?
I do see our rural colleges, particularly our small colleges, focusing on ties to the communities. I mean, PPP payments are flowing through their local banks, for example. And that's one of the things like the pandemic remind people of, is just how important these institutions are. So when the local hospital needs some N95 masks, it's the cases of masks that are being shipped from the science lab at the local university to help out the healthcare providers. When you need a place for testing that is geographically open, it ends up being the parking lot of the basketball stadium, because that's the nature of higher ed. They are our higher ed institutions are that deeply woven in the community that's the location they need to work.
And then kind of taking a left turn here, but I'm wondering about sports and independent colleges and universities. I don't think Franklin has much of a stake in that, but there are lots of independent colleges and universities that attract students because they can give them that extended sports playing experience after high school.
That's absolutely Franklin, right. I mean, go ahead, Christopher.
No, I was going to say Franklin. That's correct. Franklin doesn't have sports teams, but Urbana did. And we, you know, to Todd's point, we were very tied in with the community, established meaningful partners with the employers, the local community members attended our cultural, our academic, as well as our athletic activities. And that's the thing, you know, to talk about the value of small colleges, mm-hmm. community, you could see when that goes away, that dramatic impact it can have on a local community.
Hmm. Todd?
When we're looking at sports, there are a number of smaller independent colleges that are deeply tied to athletic programs. It's part of the education of the whole, so to speak, you
mm-hmm.
know, being able to have your body to train, to work as a team. It does depend upon where everything shakes out from the pandemic. You know, golf teams are going to have less difficulty continuing to practice, continuing to operate, except for the travel side of it. Whereas, you know, young men running into each other at high speed on the football field or in the lacrosse field, that's going to be a different story. You know, young women jumping for a basketball have very close contact when you're on the court. So we don't know what that's going to look like. But on the other hand, there is so much in society right now that is, let's figure it out as we gain more knowledge, and
mm-hmm.
universities are going to be doing the same thing.
Do obviously we're all familiar with the business model at Ohio State, how one sport primarily, maybe two, football and basketball, fund all kinds of other sports, college sports, scholarships, and that kind of a thing down the line. Is it the same way in smaller independent universities, Todd Jones?
At a face level, no. I mean, every college sport in the independent sector in Ohio loses money. However, part of the enrollment of new students does come from, hey, you can come play for us. There's an opportunity here for you. You're not quite tall enough to play Division I basketball. You could be a D2 star. And we have, for example, University of Findlay is a institution that excels at Division II basketball. Ashland University women won the national championship. So, yeah, that opportunity to play is a big part of it, and that leads to enrollment. But the question is whether that's going to decrease enrollment going forward. I think the Malone experience was instructive. Malone University ended their football program, but it wasn't as if all of those who were committed to play for Malone the next year and couldn't come went home or went somewhere else. Some did, but they were there for the education as well, which I think is a heartening sign.
Well, Christopher Washington, we have to say goodbye to you. I appreciate your time so much. Thanks.
Thank you.
Christopher Washington is Executive Vice President of Franklin University. He held the same position at Urbana University, Franklin's branch campus in Urbana. We are going to continue our conversation. We're going to introduce a very alternative option, GrooveU. We've talked to them before, and we're going to talk to them now about how an organization like theirs is handling the transition during the pandemic. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The coronavirus pandemic could require major changes in the world of traditional higher education, from academics to sports to class sizes and dorm life. The changes and destabilization of traditional institutions have inspired some to look at community colleges, apprenticeships, gap years, and more for career building. Still with us is C. Todd Jones. He's president and general counsel of the Association of Independent Colleges and Universities of Ohio. Dwight D. Heckelman is founder and director of GrooveU. That's a two-year music career program in Dublin. The school offers diplomas in music industry entrepreneurship with specializations in audio production, music business, live sound, video, interactive, and indie music. Welcome back, Dwight.
Thank you, Ann.
Dwight, how did you respond to the pandemic this spring? What kind of impact did an organization like yours face from it?
Well, I mean, I think like everyone else, we're, of course, a little bit caught off guard. But, you know, being a small institution that affords us a lot of flexibility to pivot pretty quickly. So we followed the lead of a lot of our peers in higher ed. And sort of watch what they were doing until we reached a point at which we had to sort of implement our own plans. And for us, we had about three different plans laid out before we shut down, so that based upon recommendations from health officials and the governor, we could implement any one of those three plans.
How many? Tell us about a little bit about your student body. How many? And you know how the school worked.
Sure. So it's interesting. We're really, like I said, we're pretty small. We've got about 25 students. For us, our classes are capped at 12 since the very beginning of the program. So we're able to remain in small groups kind of all the time. Of course, classes of 12 will oftentimes get split into labs of 3 to 4 students. So in our case, the impact of the shutdown. We did transition to online so that we could be, you know, safe for everybody. But we also made some other adjustments to moving the intensive lab classes to the end of the summer and implementing some other projects that we could do remotely, since we're a one-to-one tech package institution. All our students had kind of all those tools at their disposal.
Right. They already had them. But as far as the quality of the education, are you concerned?
You know, I think we were initially in terms of, you know, everybody had to transition and we were worried about how bumpy it would be. But one thing that we did is, you know, keeping students healthy and on track for graduation was really important to us. So we had a daily morning check-in. We basically kept student schedules the same. So we're block scheduled here, so our morning students meet from 9:30 in the morning till 3 in the afternoon, Monday through Thursday. They kept those classes and those class times, and at 9:15, in a small peer group with an instructor or an administrator, we would check in with them, we would see how their mental health was, we would talk with them among their peers. We expanded our student counseling services to encompass remote counseling so that we could keep everyone, you know, again, happy and healthy, which, of course, is, to answer your question, really important for student success. in doing this type of transition.
That's interesting. Todd Jones, is that a discussion that your members are talking about, just making sure that students are healthy and happy, or maybe not happy right now, but at least stable. I don't know why I use that word.
No, you're right. As the parent of a home-educated college student right now, I can tell you, nobody's really happy with the situation. But on the other hand, that's the reality of it. Colleges are, however, giving serious consideration to the mental health aspect of what fall return is going to look like. Forced separation, the potential for having people segregated in quarantine if necessary. I mean, these are real considerations. And obviously, it creates a lot of anxiety when you don't know if you're going to be able to have a sports outlet this year. You don't know if you're going to have an opportunity to meet the future Mr. or Mrs. partner that you're looking for. I mean, all of that is going to contribute to mental health issues, and our campuses are looking seriously at it.
And that's a little different than what you offer, right, Dwight?
Right. So in our case, we typically have a student health counselor on campus already. And we discussed before we transitioned, like, can we expand that service to remote counseling for students who need it? And we worked that out with our mental health professionals. But in terms of, you know, keeping them engaged, you know, we looked at ways we could do student services remotely. So one night we had a Netflix viewing party as a campus. So we picked the movie. We all tuned in. Donato's provided the pizza. We gave them a complimentary pizza, no contact from pizza from Donato's. Mm-hmm. We all sat down, ate together, used the chat window, laughed throughout the movie. You know, I think that's really important aspect that a lot of people would miss on campus, and certainly our students miss that too. But by staying closely connected through technology, I think it really helped with our student success.
Oh, and it's that smallness that enables you to do that.
Yeah, of course, you know, not possible at Ohio State, right? But, you know, having a small campus, and our students are really close anyways, so, you know, we just wanted to keep facilitating that so that they didn't feel isolated, because we don't have student housing, so some of them, you know, went to, you know, out of state in some cases, you know, to finish their classes, so we wanted to make sure we could sort of preserve the student life aspect as much as possible.
Independent colleges and universities tend to be smaller, obviously. Todd Jones, any sense about how that could be an asset going forward into this?
Well, of course, we view it as an asset generally, but in this case, the pandemic, it's an additional aspect from a couple standpoints. One is the practical side of delivering classes, which are already much smaller to start with, makes it less difficult than if you're trying to subdivide a 500-person lecture class. But on top of that is the personal interaction that one has on campus, you know, knowing your professors, knowing staff on a first-name basis, and being able to meet those, you know, individual needs, the social needs, the development needs of students. You know, that's always been a benefit, and in times of stress like COVID-19, it's going to continue.
Let's see, Beth in Grandview, you're on the air. Hi, Beth.
Hi. You know, Ohio has always had so many, maybe too many choices when it comes to college options. And it seems to me like we're hitting a perfect storm. The pandemic, you know, why should I pay full tuition if I'm not going to have a full campus experience? Maybe I should go to Columbus State, get my requirements out of the way. Coupled with, you know, the population numbers of traditionally, there's been huge declines in the number of traditionally aged college students. I'm just wondering how the math works that all of Ohio's independent colleges can survive. And, you know, each of them have, you know, huge administrative programs to keep them alive and operating, as well as restricted funds for scholarships or special things. Mm. How are people talking about, you know, preserving their unique identities, but doing business in a way that will allow them to survive? Because I just don't think they're all going to make it.
Okay. Todd Jones?
Well, I would go to the fact that there have been countless predictions of the death of independent colleges going back now for 50 years. I can go to a Carnegie Foundation report that confidently predicted one of our colleges would be dead within 5 years. It's still here today. And part of it goes to, I don't think people understand the depth of community that allows institutions to survive and then in better times thrive. And the reality is, with a few exceptions, at Ohio Independent Colleges, there's almost nobody who is paying full tuition. It's really a matter of what is net tuition, and net tuition in this state has been flat after inflation for 15 years. The question is, can you make the adjustments necessary to do these things? And unlike larger institutions, the administrative burden isn't there in the same way. So if you go to Art Academy of Cincinnati, for example, there are 8 full-time faculty, but some of the faculty take duties that would be related to admission. I mean, that's just how a small structure works differently than a large institution, and it allows them to have a resiliency that wouldn't exist if you have to cut administrative staff when what you're doing at an independent college is restructuring duties to fill needs.
Dwight Huckelman, from where you sit, do you feel in a better position to pivot with this pandemic?
Yeah, I think I would agree with C. Todd there that the idea here is we're better positioned than most larger institutions are. You know, the idea of a student sitting on a parent's couch and paying $30,000-$40,000 for an education versus a niche school like ours and like others that can provide real practical hands-on experience that you can't get. If the school can't carve that out for themselves and carve it out for themselves in a smaller environment, then they probably won't survive. But I think smaller colleges have a lot more flexibility to do that.
Beth, thanks for that call. You know, I was wondering, Dwight, if you'd ever, as you've grown and stabilized over the last, it's about 10 years now, right?
Correct, yeah.
Yeah, if you've thought about creating a, what's the word I'm searching for, establishing relationships with larger institutions.
So we looked at that initially, actually, pretty hard if we wanted to do, articulation agreements and those types of things. And, you know, to the point of the previous caller, we're so specialized that, you know, if a student were, say, to attend our institution and desire a bachelor's degree, which is something we don't offer, mm-hmm. they would basically attend, they would get their upper-level coursework with us, and then they would want to go back to school to get their core classes, right, their gen eds. Mm-hmm. And we haven't found a student yet that wants to do that.
Okay.
You know, that's kind of our appeal is, you know, we don't have the gen ed, so you can get right in, get to the technical, get to the things that you really want to learn. So the idea of we looked at one point of expanding to encompass more students as we grew, and ultimately we decided that we wanted to remain small. And I think if we were to partner with a larger institution, some of those challenges would be inherent in trying to accommodate a larger student body that we're just not really equipped for.
And Todd Jones, we're just about out of time, but I wanted to get your sense about how, you know, universe or independents might pare down their offerings going forward to create more of a niche that's more manageable as we move forward with this.
I think this will be one of those opportunities where colleges, not just small independents, but also larger colleges, pair their offerings to what they're best at and what is most essential. If you look around and say, well, we've had this program for 30 years, but we're now down to a handful of students, maybe it's time to shift the focus of what we do. And you can see that in places like, for example, Hiram College, which changed their entire academic structure to be more appealing to what students are looking for now. And you see that in various ways. It takes time at our colleges because of shared governance and the sense of community, but it is that evolution, and sometimes events like this allow it to happen a little faster.
Well, we will continue to cover this. In the meantime, I appreciate your time so much. C. Todd Jones, President and General Counsel for the Association of Independent Colleges and Universities of Ohio. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
And Dwight Huckelman, Founder, Director of GrooveU, thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you, Ann.
That's it for now. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.